are now listening to the IELTS podcast. Learn from tutors and ex-examiners who are masters of IELTS preparation. Your host, Ben Worthington.
Band 9 speaking. Grammar examples from an ex-IELTS examiners. Hello there, IELTS podcast students. In this tutorial, as I just said, we're going to be looking at Band 9 grammar for your speaking exam. And we will be assisted by the ex-IELTS examiner, probably the most famous ex-IELTS examiner on the planet at the moment, Rob Buckinghamshire.
At the moment. Fame is only for 20 minutes, according to somebody. Andy Warhol says that, 20 minutes. The podcast is a bit longer than 20 minutes,
but there'll be more opportunities for global stardom and international notoriety. I butchered that pronunciation. Anyway, my name is Ben Worthington.
Notoriety.
Thank you. I could see it, but I couldn't remember.
I know. I have the same problem. It happened.
All right. So my name is Ben Worthington, and I'm from the north of England. That's why some of my words will be pronounced slightly differently from what you're accustomed to. Fortunately, I do not speak with a broad Yorkshire accent anymore. That got kicked out of me while I was being knocked about the world teaching English. And now I've got a pretty standardized accent. But anyway, yeah, I left England, started teaching in Spain, quickly specialized in with IELTS. And how did I get specialized? Well, I interviewed experts, pronunciation professionals, linguistic experts, all the people I could find, experienced university tutors, ex-IELTS examiners, and then I took what they told me. If it worked, I put it into my online course, Jump to Band 7, or it's free. If it didn't work, I threw it out and just carried on interviewing. Now, Robert, you've been a university tutor in your time, haven't you?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Where did you teach?
Well, I taught at the main university in Venezuela for many, many years, 26 years, actually.
I put in my
time there because they give you a pension after after 25 years.
Okay.
Well, I actually really enjoyed it because it gave me the chance to work together with a lot of very interesting people. Not too many of them were English teachers. In fact, I was working with alongside collaborating with engineers and scientists, mathematicians, people from the physics department, etc. It was an exciting time. I really enjoyed it. The main thing was, the creative aspect, creating courses, English courses, because as you know, I mean, all over the world, English being the language of science, technology, academic subjects in general. I mean, all the students needed some kind of help with their English, whether it be reading, writing, and of course, as well, speaking. It's one of those horrible facts of life, isn't it? I mean, as native speakers, we're the lucky ones. I mean, okay, we can learn other languages and enjoy speaking other languages, but so many British people in particular just don't bother to learn other languages. I think it's a terrible shame that it's a terrible thing, but other people in other countries, to get on in life, they not only have to be experts in their field, but the only way to really do that successfully is also to handle the English language. It's a lot to ask young people to not only study their subjects, but also learn another language to be able to do it.
Absolutely, and
it's
studying.
Not easy.
In that language, in a different language as well, is like another level of complexity on top of, of the actual subject matter. So, yeah.
Exactly.
People who learn English to such a high level, they often discount it. And they often even start with like, oh, I apologize for my English. And I'm like, don't apologize.
They shouldn't. Exactly.
I should be speaking your language in your country.
Exactly.
Don't apologize at all. And I've never had this burden of having to learn the language to further my career. I mean, maybe to a certain extent with Spanish, but my main career has been teaching English. So it never really had to develop it so much, my Spanish. But anyway, let's get on to today's tutorial. We're going to be talking about grammar in the speaking test. And Rob's going to give us a few examples of what band nine grammar is. Is that right, Rob?
That's right. Although, you know, I think what's in my mind today really is tips, yes, examples, yes, but I want us to all kind of sit down for a moment and think about this. I mean, what exactly is grammar? I mean, yes, I'm going to give you a few examples, but this topic does kind of worry me a bit. I mean, I'll tell you why. I mean, let's start with the band descriptors, you know, those famous things that the examiners have when they're trying to evaluate, to assess each candidate, whether it's writing or in speaking. Now, in speaking, to get a band nine in the grammatical area, what we call GRA, grammatical range and accuracy, it says this, that the test taker, one, uses a full range of structures naturally and appropriately. Every word counts here. Full range of structures naturally? What does that really mean? And appropriately. Interesting. And two, produces consistently accurate structures apart from slips, characteristic of native speaker speech. I mean, slips can happen all the time.
Yeah,
they can.
I know somebody who's notorious for those.
Yeah. yes. We all make mistakes. We all when we're tired, when we've just got up in the morning, we say things. Oh, sorry, what did I say? We make little slips of whatever type. But strangely enough, for writing, it says more or less the same thing. That's what worries me. I mean, for writing, it says. For band nine, uses a wide range of structures with full flexibility and accuracy. Rare minor errors occur only as slips. So what does that all really mean? And what's the examiner looking out for? I really can't tell you 100%, really, because there's a difference between written grammar and spoken grammar. I mean, that's what I've trying to get across today, really. I mean, I think it's something that we tend not to emphasize so much. Perhaps in the descriptors, that is implied when it says naturally and appropriately for the speaking part. Although we could use that for both the written and the spoken grammar, I think. I mean, what I really think is the problem is that we've all grown up, all of us, with this notion somewhere in our heads that the written form of the language, any language, is somehow more correct than the spoken one. I mean, we talk about well-formed sentences and complex verb tenses and whatever, and forget that spoken English also has its own characteristics, which may be quite different to the written version, especially when we assume that by written, we mean the more formal academic writing style that we're testing in IELTS, I don't know. I mean, does that help? I mean, a little bit for us to understand why language learners worldwide, all over the world, find their initial contact with real spoken English hard, because the language that they've been exposed to in the classroom is this more formal written version. I mean, we all know that we don't speak the same way as we write. I mean, we even say things like in English, don't we? Oh, he talks like a book. So, I mean, when we're laughing at those people who speak very formally, why are you talking like a book? But if, as teachers, we're teaching the book version of English, then maybe people should be laughing at us. I mean, it's the teachers who are making the mistake here. I mean, I'm saying this because I know that thousands and thousands of IELTS test takers have probably learned English in this kind of formal grammar, rule-based environment, and for that reason, find the speaking test challenging because it involves real face-to-face interaction. Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, let's think about this. I've got three examples. Let me give you these three examples. Each one will illustrate an aspect of English grammar considered to be complex, and as such, the kind of grammar we should be using in IELTS speaking to obtain a really high band score. Okay, let's go for the first one. The first one, of course, is, our old friend, conditional sentences. I mean, it's fun to teach students enjoy learning it, you know, because it's almost like a mathematics class. You know, there are three types of conditional. You know, well, if I hadn't become an English language teacher, I would have become, you know, oh, a prison officer or something like that. So it's a great opportunity, of course, for you, the test takers, to show the examiner how well you handle this structure. And, you know, what about in that typical part one question? You know, because in part one, you've got the two topics after the first introductory thing about, you know, where do you work or where do you study or what do you study or where do you live, etc. And the examiner asks two sets of questions. And in each set of questions, there are four questions. The last question in each of those four sets is typically like this. I mean, let's take this one about photography. The last question could be, would you like to learn more about photography? This is a great opportunity to use a bit more complexity in your language. I mean, listen to this answer. All right, it's invented. I wrote it. Is it genuine? It is, in a sense, because I wrote it. Is it natural? Maybe not, because I wrote it by myself. I wasn't talking to anybody. So listen to this. Would you like to learn more about photography? Don't know. Maybe. I mean, if it didn't take up too much time, I might. It's not that I want to be a professional or anything, but it's always nice to learn new things, isn't it? Yeah, I guess if I had the chance. Okay, yeah, my example is invented, but I'm trying to show how spoken English and therefore spoken grammar is not exactly the same as the formal written variety. I mean, the conditional parts are there. If it didn't take up too much time, I might. If I had the chance, I've got two examples of the past, of the conditional. If I had the chance, if it didn't take up too much time, I might. But the sentences, if we can call them that, are different to written English. They appear less complete. A lot of things are left unsaid. For example, if it didn't take up too much time, I might what?
Interesting. So just to clarify for the listeners, like, what we've got here is advanced structures, and it's the structures that are important, but perhaps the actual words and the style that's coming across, they don't sound so advanced, because that's not what we're used to when we think of sort of like formal academic English. But whereas what you're saying is that the spoken one is going to be different, and it might not sound high level, but it is, because it's the structures that count, and they're not going to be presented in the same way that you might have learned them or that you might think formal high scoring structures. Is that right?
That's right. Because, of course, you know, most of our conversations are not taken up by speaking in sentences. I mean, even this idea of a sentence is an artificial idea. It's a concept which refers to written grammar, if you like. I mean, where does a sentence begin and where does it end? Well, it begins with a capital letter and ends with a full stop. That's it. It could be a sentence, could be help! Exclamation mark. That's a sentence. Okay. I mean, it doesn't have to be grammatical in the same sense that formal written English is. I mean, we could have things. I mean, let's go on to my second example. I mean, leaving things unsaid. If we don't say something in grammatical terms, there's a word for that. We call it ellipsis. Ellipsis. Wonderful word, isn't it? In written English, it plays a part. In written English, but it's never really considered to be either complex or that frequent. I mean, you get it in grammar books, you know, particularly at kind of fairly basic levels. I mean, a simple example in a grammar book for English would be, I had one hamburger, but Ben had three. And so the teacher asked the stupid questions. Okay, had three what? What did Ben have three? Well, he had three hamburgers, because I don't have to repeat it. Yeah. I don't have to repeat. And that is an example of ellipsis in a very, very simple simple example. We just omit the second use of hamburger or hamburgers. But in spoken English, I mean, especially when we're exchanging information, for example, in part one of IELTS, and also to a large extent in part three, ellipsis is much more frequent. I mean, we're using shortcuts all the time. I mean, going back to that photography example, I mean, we've got the text there. I mean, the first word, I used it, and it's written there when you check this out on online, the script of this podcast. I'm not saying I don't know. I'm just saying, don't know. Oh, I don't know. I mean, if I'm speaking English naturally, hey, where's my, have you seen my phone? No, I don't know. It's like a noise. We don't often say it. I don't know. It sounds like we're annoyed if we say that, you know.
Exactly, to emphasize, we might say it every single, I do not know. That's very, very, very clear. And almost annoyed when you say, if you say it like that.
Exactly. I mean, but this dunno is perfectly acceptable in everyday informal conversation. I mean, but let's read that little answer I gave again. I mean, how many other examples of ellipsis are there? Let me read it again. Let's think about it as I'm reading it. Don't know. I mean, maybe. I mean, if it didn't take up too much time, I might. It's not that I want to be a professional or anything, but it's always nice to learn new things, isn't it? Yeah, I guess if I had the chance. So, let's see. I mean, I've got at least three. Okay. Well, I've forgotten one. I've left one out. My fourth one is after maybe I would like to learn more about photography, but I just say maybe.
And you just imply that, don't you? Because that's
exactly top. Yeah, exactly. And after I might be interested in learning more about photography. And it's not that I want to be a professional or anything. A professional what? A professional photographer.
Yeah.
And also that or anything. And that's so common. I mean, it's just a part of the way we speak. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't really, it just means like, I don't want to be a professor. I don't really want to go into that field or go into that field any further. Exactly. But we just say, or anything. Yeah, it means like, or anything else in that field or any other profession related to photography. Exactly. But it's just implied, isn't it?
Exactly. And it's also part of that very common expression when we, you know, are almost apologizing sometimes. I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt or anything.
Yeah.
I don't want to appear rude or anything. I mean, the or anything is kind of trying to make that previous word a little less obvious. I don't know.
It's these little nuances, isn't it?
Exactly. I don't want to insult you or anything. And of course, the other one is right at the end. I mean, I guess if I had the chance, I mean, if I had the chance to learn more about photography or if I had the chance to take a course in photography. So, of course, there's a lot of things when we're speaking that we don't say because we don't need to, because we're interacting. I think the word you often find in books about conversational exchanges is negotiating. I mean, it sounds horrible, doesn't it? We can negotiate meaning. It goes back and forth. We're trying to find some way of communicating. I mean, and going back to that band 9 descriptor, you know, it refers to a full range of structures naturally and appropriately. And so what I'm saying, what I'm suggesting here is that the use of ellipsis is exactly what we need to show off that naturalness and appropriacy. I mean, we don't talk in full sentences. We imply things. We make references to things that, of course, are in the conversation because we don't have to mention them. The same would be, of course, in writing when we talk about cohesion and coherence. It's there in the writing test as well. But today we're talking about speaking. I mean, one more point, and I think this is also very interesting. The grammar books call this, and it sounds weird, question tags. It's something that most language books and courses tend to neglect these days, I think, don't they? I mean, you don't often find it mentioned that much, do you?
Not I mean, really, no.
I gave an example before, didn't I? In my opinion, I think we'd all agree that it does play an essential role in what we could call, you know, establishing or negotiating meaning in conversation. I mean, let's take an example from part three speaking. I mean, a test taker is asked about whether it's better to read the book before seeing the film or the other way around, the classic one, you know, do you think it's better to read the book first or watch the film, watch the movie first? I mean, this is a possible answer. Again, I wrote it, it's invented, it's not natural in the sense that somebody really said this. Somebody really invented it, and that was me. Okay, there you go. So, is it better to read the book first or watch the film? Or what do you think? Well, that maybe depends on the type of book we're talking about, doesn't it? I mean, take, for example, a murder mystery, an Agatha Christie, for example. It's just a narrative, a story, isn't it? The dialogues might be important, but the characters don't have too much depth, do they? So I guess it could be better, couldn't it? I mean, the film first, that is. Okay, it's exaggerated. I know. I exaggerated that point a bit, but you get the idea, no? I mean, speaking grammar is different to written grammar. I've got four examples because I'm trying to make contact. We talked in another podcast recently about eye contact. This is kind of language contact, you know? Well, it depends on the type of thing we're talking about, doesn't it? I mean, look about Agatha Christie. It's just a story, isn't it? I mean, it's not serious, is it? I mean, the dialogues might be important, but the characters in an Agatha Christie novel, they don't have too much depth. They're kind of caricatures. They're like pieces of wood, aren't they? I mean...
And I'll just mention, like, these question tags, they are used in spoken English, and sometimes you can use them just to sort of, like, check for meaning. Like, exactly. Are you sure it's there? Are you, really? Really?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
for, exactly. Like, emphasis. Of,
exactly.
But in the exam... you don't have to wait for the examiner to like confirm your question tag, like say, I don't know, we're talking about a book, aren't we? You don't have to wait for the examiner to say, yes, we are. You can just carry on. And that's like totally natural, you know? Exactly. And so just because I could imagine like a student might just go and research question tags, and in a dialogue, there is that interaction where the other speaker will kind of close it or confirm it, but it's also perfectly acceptable, as we've just demonstrated, to kind of like just ask the question tag and just carry on. And you don't have to wait for it to be sort of like closed. You can just carry on.
Exactly. Very good point. I mean, they're so common. I mean, because it is this idea of, you know, I'm trying to get my point across, and I'm trying. I mean, as you say, I mean, question tags are often used to either get someone to agree with you. See what I mean? You see what I mean, don't you? I mean, I'm trying to get you on my side when I say that. I mean, because that's what it's all about. We don't want enemies, we want friends. And so in conversation, we are using these a lot to establish those kind of contacts in a very natural way. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's difficult at this point. I mean, speaking grammar is different to written grammar. I mean, how would that last one score in a written exam? If that were a written exam, well, never a 9, never an 8 either, or even a 7. I mean, I just don't know. But for speaking, for me, that would be great. I mean, just an odd example I didn't think of yesterday, but I mean, I remember a few years ago, there was this guy that was going to be a new examiner. And they said, hey, Rob, can you keep an eye on, you know, whatever his name was, for this his first session? I said, yeah. And I showed him the ropes. You know, I had to, you know, open the doors and set up the equipment and stuff like that. And after we finished that session, he came into me because he was checking the scores. He said, Rob, can I ask you a question? He said, I just interviewed a guy and he's really good. In fact, I knew the guy that he interviewed because he was one of my students. Uh-huh. He was a doctor, perfectly bilingual, actually. And he was going off to the UK, which he did in the end, to do a 2-year session working in a hospital in the UK as an invited medical expert. He's back in Venezuela, a very, very excellent doctor. And I said, oh, yeah, I know that guy. He's really good, isn't he? He said, yeah, he is good. But I found that when he was speaking, he didn't use too many phrasal verbs. Ooh. And should I give him an 8 instead of a 9? I said, I really don't know. I mean, for me, that guy's a 9. He's bilingual. I said, maybe he doesn't use too many phrasal verbs, as you call them. You know, I don't know what examples you're talking about, but because he is a doctor and he's used to, you know, speaking in Latin or something. So his language is a bit formal. I know. I said, don't forget also, I mean, you look at his name, and he was born here, but his parents came from India.
Right.
I said, don't forget that is another aspect. I said, this guy is perfectly bilingual. Yeah. Said, he went away and I think he gave him a 9. But I mean, it's a point I'm making because this guy, you know, a local man, he wasn't a native speaker, but a good teacher. He's learning this the hard way, you know, studying it himself. He was worried because he wasn't sure about the natural sound of this man's language. And you know, we talked about it for a while, but it's something that worries all of us. What's natural, what is not? I mean, often, you know, people do. And it's no fault of their own because of the way they've been taught and the way they've learned in English in their culture. So they often do speak English as if it were, you know, something rather like the written version. But it is different. And you know, when all of you out there do get your 7s and 8s in IELTS and do go to an English-speaking country to study, you're going to find, of course, that, you know, that attending a seminar or a university class is completely different from, you know, absolutely, hearing the language in the street, as we've all experienced ourselves, for example.
So many students have said to me, like, yeah, I got to England, I got to Birmingham or to London or wherever, and I realized
didn't understand
a word. It wasn't just the language. It wasn't just the words. It was sort of like the accent, the language, you know, there's different structures and all these little things we've talked about, you know, like the assumptions with the ellipsis and the question tags and all of this.
Yeah.
It just goes to show you like how complex and how challenging it can be for an examiner, because they've got to take into account all of these other aspects. And it's tough. But if you do want to improve your English, and not just for landing in and using it in England, Australia or Canada or wherever your target country is for the exam, then get in contact to IELTSpodcast.com, and we've got the speaking confidence course, and we've also got the IELTSpodcast.com/live courses going on every single week for summer. And come along. I'd love to see you. I'd love to see the faces of my listeners. We can interact. We can talk about the essays, about speaking. We can do some exercises together, and we can help you get that band 7, 8, or 9. So anything else you want to say, Rob, before
great. Sounds great. It's great. I mean, you know, get into that course in the summer. Sounds great. Sounds a very good idea. Great ideas, great activities, and get proper professional advice on IELTSpodcast.com. Yeah, great. Good.
All right. Thank you very much for listening. Have a super day and good luck with your IELTS preparation.
IELTSpodcast.com.